Support for Reporting on Technology and Innovation comes from Juna Sleep System. Personalize your mattress. More information at junasleep.com. I'm Kara Headland. Welcome back to Innovation. And joining me now on the phone is Dr. Ranjit Kudali. He's a professor of chemistry at the University of South Dakota. Dr. K, thanks for joining us today.
Kara, it's a pleasure to be on SDPB.
So we're going to talk today about the Nobel Prize in Chemistry that was awarded recently. And it's all about a microscope.
Absolutely. So the Nobel Prizes in the science discipline, economics, and peace were just announced during the past week. And so the prize in chemistry for 2017 was shared by three scientists equally, Jacques Dubochet, Joachim Frank, and Richard Henderson. And the Nobel Prize Committee awarded these three scientists the prize for developing cryo-electron microscopy for high-resolution structural determination of biomolecules and solutions. That's
okay.
The exact citation.
What does that mean?
All right. So
let's break it down.
Oh, absolutely. So so I use the word cryo-electron microscopy, the citation head. So let's try to understand first what electron microscopy is, and then we'll go to the need for cryo-electron microscopy. So challenge in using light microscopes, for example, is, well, when we want to look at objects that are quite small, we need a microscope, and we use light. For example, if we want to see a bug, for example, we can see the outer features of a bug using a light microscope. But there is a fundamental limitation when we want to actually look at finer details, and that is because if we use light as the source, then the resolution, the maximum resolution, I should say, that we can obtain is limited by the wavelength of light. So the limitation of light microscopes that we use in high schools and sometimes in freshman undergraduate labs is the fact that the maximum resolution that we can get is limited by the wavelength of light. And typically, we need visible light, and so the visible light has the wavelength ranges from 400 to 800 nanometers. So if we are actually looking at structures below 400 nanometers or so, light microscopes will not do, which means that we need other sources to visually observe objects at sizes lower than, let's say, 400 nanometers. So that's where electron microscopes come.
So this basically allows researchers the chance to kind of freeze biomolecules mid-movement.
So in a way, so what actually the invention of the electron microscope itself resulted in a Nobel Prize, but in the discipline of physics. So in order to circumvent the limitation of light microscopes, scientists developed electron as a source. So electrons have very low wavelength and what physicists and chemists call a de Broglie wavelength. So their wavelengths are very small, and so we utilize that to look at objects that have 30 nanometers, 1 nanometer, 100 nanometers, etc. So a person by the name of Ernst Ruska, along with Max Noll, actually demonstrated that electrons can be utilized for looking at extremely small particles. And the first transmission electron microscope, there are several modes, a scanning and a transmission mode. At first, commercial transmission electron microscope was commercialized somewhere in the late 1930s, 1939 or so. And Ernst Ruska, who was instrumental in developing this technique, actually got the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1986. But there is a fundamental limitation, Kara, for a conventional electron microscope, be it in the scanning mode or transmission mode. And that is because biological molecules are not as robust and stable in comparison to inorganic molecules or materials. So in a regular electron microscope, let's say a transmission electron microscope, one needs to apply high vacuum. And also, one needs to get a high resolution, we need to use very high voltages. And we're talking about 100 kilovolts, 200 kilovolts, and sometimes as high as 400 kilovolts. So what essentially happens is when you have these biological molecules that have a lot of carbon-hydrogen bonds, they essentially are not stable when you have highly powerful electron beams hitting them. And so it was actually noted by some biologists that when Ernst Ruska got the Nobel Prize, there was a paper published, and it was noted that, well, alas, you know, biological molecules cannot be utilized, or biological molecules cannot utilize transmission electron microscopy. And in one of the papers, one of the scientists commented that the destruction of organic cells by the intense electronic bombardment would preclude a whole class of biological molecules not being investigated by this technique. So this actually prompted several scientists, such as Richard Henderson, who is actually a Scottish molecular biologist, and it prompted him to look at ways and means to see how can we get a good structure of proteins, viruses, etc. And he was intrigued by the use of electron microscopy, but he understood the limitations that conventional transmission electron microscopes could not be utilized because they would be damaged by the high intense electron beams. So in the mid-70s or so, Henderson, Richard Henderson, was actually trying to look at a particular protein called bacteriorhodopsin, and that's used for transporting protons across the cell. And so he had published a landmark paper wherein he could use a low resolution, under low resolution conditions, he could deduce the structure of these protein. And later on, Joachim Frank, who is actually at Columbia University in New York City, but is a German-born American biophysicist, collaborated with Richard Henderson. And Frank was actually also looking at structures of proteins. And together they identified ways and means and came up with this technique of cryo-electron microscopy. So essentially what happens in this is that you're using electrons, but you're actually you're preventing the destruction of these proteins and these biomolecules by actually having a frozen protein solution. So that was the trick, to freeze proteins very quickly at very low temperatures by using ethane, for example, liquid ethane at minus 196 degrees centigrade. And then that vitreous frozen solution in which the protein is encapsulated prevents the destruction of the protein.
And then you're able to see it.
Absolutely.
Right? A 3D dimensional type of image?
Oh, absolutely. So that's also very critical. So what has happened in the past is that although this cryo-electron microscopy was developed a few years ago in the mid-70s, it took advances in technology, for example, in instrumentation of electron microscopy, and most importantly, something that you touched upon, Kara, is software, actually. So initially, when these images were obtained, one could not use high-intense beams. One had to go to low accelerating voltage. And so at those voltages, you do not get a very high resolution. So what essentially people obtained were these density maps. You kind of know what the structure of this protein is, but you do not have a very a good super resolution. So the way I can, the analogy I can give is, let's say we have, for example, a baseball and it or a basketball. It's got you can look at a shape, for example, it's a sphere, but the fine features, these basketball has these black lines going around it. You cannot see the fine details and the texture of the basketball, for example. So the protein structures that were deduced many years ago did not have sophisticated software, and so one would get these blobs, essentially. In fact, many of these scientists who published these results of these protein structure were kind of derided, and the whole field was called blobology. And so it took really intense efforts from software engineers to convert the images that they obtained by cryo-electron microscopy to process these images and to get a highly magnified image with high resolution and details at the atomic level.
So what has, with the creation of these microscopes, sure. What has, I mean, how has chemistry benefited in the long run, and what have we been able to learn that we wouldn't have without them?
Oh, great question. So we know that, you know, you want to treat diseases, for example, you have to really and find effective cures. The conformation and structure of biomolecules like proteins are very essential. So we talk about a key and lock mechanism for proteins. So when you want to bind some therapeutic drugs to very key sites in the protein, you actually have to know at the structure of this protein in great detail down to the atomic level. So what this will help is in unraveling the structure of the protein very clearly, so we know how these individual protein molecules will fold and at atomic resolution, and that will give tools for chemists to design drugs to specifically dock to key sites in the protein so that it can do its function. So this will have a transformative effect on the design of effective drug molecules that can bind very specifically to key protein sites. And that's where I think chemists will be using this knowledge from cryo-electron microscopy to better design drugs that can target and bind to very specific sites.
So there really isn't a need for blobologists?
Absolutely. So what I did not mention, Kara, was that conventionally the structure of proteins were determined by a technique called X-ray crystallography, and that is why the most widely used technique still to obtain information about the structure, the conformation of large biological molecules like protein. But a fundamental problem of X-ray crystallography is that you will have to crystallize a protein. And some proteins, by inherent nature, do not crystallize into single crystals. And so the X-ray crystallography had an inherent defect in that it was not able to help in elucidating the structure of proteins that were hard to crystallize. And that's where people like Jacques Dubochet, Joachim Frank, and Richard Henderson took the knowledge from electron microscope scopic techniques and used powerful algorithms, software, and developed this cryo-electron microscopic technique to elucidate the structure of biological molecules.
Were you pleased this was the Nobel Prize winner this year?
Well, there's a lot of debate among chemists that, and when you look at particularly the last 10 years, Kara, a number of prizes awarded to chemists for the Nobel Prize in Chemistry have gone to scientists who have worked largely in the area of biochemistry, medicine, drug delivery, etc. So there are some traditional chemists who no doubt are appreciate the recognition of scientists like Jacques, Joachim, and Richard, but they're disappointed that the committees are disproportionately favoring scientists who have a leaning towards bio, health, medicine, and they feel that those the awards should for scientists should go in medicine, for example.
Oh, okay. Dr. Kudelli, I want to thank you so much for taking time and coming on the program today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure as always, Kara.